podcast is a member of WildGamesProductions.com and D20Radio.com.
Between the time when wargamers played with chainmail and the rise of the Wizards of the Coast, there was an age of gamers. And unto this, Gygax, destined to bear the crown jewel of TSR upon a troubled brow, to show you all how to roll for initiative.
The Roll for Initiative Podcast, volume number 2, issue number 84. We are back this week. DM Vince sitting here alongside DM Matt.
Hi, everyone.
And fresh from conventions and popping his head up, DM Will.
What's up?
There he is. And Nick is not with us tonight because he has a previous engagement to go to, but, you know, we'll try to make up the slack without him being here. So, what have you been up to? Well, you said you want to talk a little bit about convention. Matt, you got to
It's just been, you know, we haven't done a show in a while, I think. How long has it been? What, 3 weeks?
Well, 3 weeks to us, the listeners really haven't noticed.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, that's great then. Well, no, you know, I did, I went to Enfilade, which is the largest historical gaming convention here on the West Coast, as far as I'm concerned it is. That's how it's advertised anyway. But, no, I had a great time. It's, you know, a well-run convention. The attendance record was broken big time. So, you know, I did a lot of gaming there. I just had an absolute fun time, especially when it comes around miniatures. You know, when we talk about, you know, D&D First Edition, and, you know, a lot of people don't like the miniature side of the house. Well, let me tell you. Miniatures are great to have, and I participated in a lot of games, and I'll be posting those pictures up real soon on the site there, whether it's historical. I did some Starfleet battles. There's a new game that, well, I don't think it's an older game. I don't know if you're all familiar with A Call to War, Star Trek.
Yeah, I've never heard of it.
You never heard of it? Well, what it is, it's like a really, 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 really watered-down Starfleet battles game or rule set, and the best thing about it is the miniatures. I'm not a fan of the rules. However, the miniatures I'm a total fan of, and I plan on buying a bunch of those. So,
that's, you know, on last year, they're really good looking.
Yeah, for Mongoose Publishing, yes, they made a very good line of miniatures, with especially the Klingons of the Federation. They're just absolute gorgeous, great detail on them. Still had to paint them, though, and all that stuff. But you know what, though? That's the fun part in it.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So, yeah, so that worked out real good. So that convention was awesome. I got PaizoCon next month during the July 4th weekend holiday, somewhere in that time period. And then I got Dragonflight in August. So I'm really looking forward for this year to come to an end, because next year I'm going to get away from the board game schedule a little bit and just do half board games. And then the other half will be the first edition AD&D schedule, where I'll be running games at all the 6 to 8 conventions I go to next year.
Hmm.
So it's been crazy. It's been crazy. Let me tell you, a lot of gaming, though. A lot of gaming. Tons of it.
Cool. Yeah, I was myself at ReaperCon, which is pretty cool. That's like the mecca of minis itself. Most people, there were some people coming from out of the country to this little local convention. I couldn't believe it, but I guess according to them, that's like the mecca of all minis at Con, ReaperCon. But you're saying yours is, so I don't know which one is.
No, no, mine is historical wargaming.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, mine's a historical wargaming convention. So if people want to know the roots of D&D, they need to go to a historical wargaming convention, because that was where it started at back in the day. That's how it all started, with Gygax and Arneson and the whole gang of them. That's where it started at. So, I mean, the one disappointment was that the guy that did Circus Maximus, I mean, he didn't show up this year, which was kind of sad, because he has the best Circus Maximus board in the world. And sorry, Cask, if you listen to this, he destroys your board by a mile. But this guy's board is like 15 feet long, and it's 8 feet wide, I believe. 7 feet wide. So it's a huge thing. And, you know, we got the full-size chariots, the whole thing with the Circus Maximus thing. So, I mean, it's huge. And that's the highlight of the convention. Unfortunately, this year he didn't schedule. So kind of missed him.
Yeah. ReaperCon, like I was saying, I played a lot of role-playing games. I didn't actually participate in any mini contests. I just played a lot of Star Wars Saga Edition. They had Order 66 was there live.
Yeah.
Wow.
So they held about 12 different events, and I played most of them. It was a lot of fun. I got to sit on their podcast and pimp our podcast too, so yeah. More people will be listening.
Excellent.
I participated in the auction on Sunday, and I won with GM Chris. Two of us combined won two rare boxes of WEG Star Wars minis.
Ooh.
Wow.
Yeah, one was Rebel Troopers, and one was the Empire Strikes Back Collector's Edition.
Excellent.
Yeah, we got them for using Reaper Bucks, which I don't know what the Reaper Bucks actually are, but I guess that's their way of money there.
Yeah, it's their way of basically for playing in events and doing things, you earn your Reaper Bucks to get stuff in the auction. So it kind of encourages you to be active in all the other stuff going on as opposed to just showing up with a boatload of cash and buying the rare stuff.
No, that's a good deal.
I was trying to figure out how they actually make money in the auction using Reaper Bucks. So you go to a game, you play the game for 2 hours, you get 50 Reaper Bucks. If you play for 4 hours, you get 100 Reaper Bucks. How are they making money if you're using the Reaper Bucks in the auctions? What I was trying to figure out.
I can tell you how that works in a way, and if they do it the same way that I did when I went down to GameStorm down in Vancouver, Washington. When you run your games, now this only goes for the DMs and GMs and CMs or whatever M's they are out there for their games they're running. If you run a two-hour game, you get a two-hour token. If you run a one-hour game, you get a one-hour token, and so on and so on and so on. You take these tokens and then you turn them in. They're worth 20 tokens is worth 20 points or whatever the case may be. And then they'll have items there. All this stuff is donated stuff. They never paid for this. So they're not really losing money on giving that stuff away.
No, I think with Reaper, it's stuff they actually just kind of have laying around.
That's true.
But it's more of – but the players also get these bucks, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, the players get the bucks. Every game session, they get the bucks. We're sitting there. But Reaper was giving away Reaper stuff too. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, so I sat in five games, for example. I get 500 Reaper bucks, and you're giving away a rare – Reaper mini color paint set, and I bid on it, for example, say I win it for $300. How is Reaper really making any money off of that?
If you look at Reaper, though, what is their cost on it? Because since they made it,
they did,
from a collector standpoint, an open secondary market standpoint, they're losing a lot of money.
But
from their, as the people that made it, they're not losing that much because they got it at cost.
Yeah, and you know what? And you know, it all comes down to it. It might be something that was wrote off as a loss, and they get the money back anyway, so it makes no difference.
Right, and plus, also, they're building goodwill amongst all those people there, making them a little more passionate about Reaper, more likely to spend more money buying Reaper stuff.
That's the whole point.
So yeah, they may be losing some money on stuff that costs them very little but has a high secondary market value, but that goodwill they're building by giving it away is priceless.
Yep. That's probably what it is, though. So ReaperCon, they had a lot of their miniatures down there?
Oh, yeah. There was tons of you can do speed painting, skill painting. You can sit down for an hour and pick out any mini you wanted to. You had to pay for the painting classes, but you could pick out whatever mini you wanted. And you got to paint it, and you got to keep it at the end.
No, that's not wrong with that. And you know what? I saw the new line of Reaper Minis, the Bones, which is their I don't know if it's not plastic.
I actually interviewed Reaper Brian at Origins, and we talked about it. I forget what he said the exact type is, but basically it's a type of material that doesn't require primer.
See, that's awesome. That is, I mean, those miniatures are excellent. I found them to be very worthwhile. I saw them at Infolod. They're really nice. And like I said, they're using the same mold that they did with the metal ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But way cheaper. And right. That's the best part.
Yeah. They don't require primer. And Brian said they were created out of a need because when they do all these speed paints and paint intakes, they had to actually, prior to those minis, prime everything themselves. So they were spending all this time priming these minis for these paint intakes that were so popular. And they're just like, why don't we come up with something where we don't have to do this? We can just stick that mini out there and let people paint and not worry about it. And then at that point, so they made it for the paint and takes, then they discovered all the Reaper employees wanted to take them home. At that point, they're like, we should just sell these.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense and everything. I still think that I would prime some of them because, for example, like the undead skeletons.
Yeah.
Or with the skeletons, I have to prime them black. They got to be black for me because I use, you know, the white and the ochre yellow and all the other crazy crap on there. Because they're already solid white. I can't do it backwards with black, so
right.
They have to be primed a certain color. But you're right, they don't need a prime, and that's pretty hard to do as a painter of so many years. The first thing you do to a miniature, well, you know, besides taking all the flash off, prime them.
Right.
That's just odd. That's weird.
Yeah. Yeah, so for paint and takes, you don't want people sitting there priming their mini, waiting for the primer to dry, then coming back and painting it. You want them to actually be painting and putting colors on their figure. That's the fun part, not priming. So they were priming all of those figures by hand prior to the bones.
They was priming them by hand. Why was that? Why didn't they just use spray paint?
When I say by hand, I mean they actually had to physically do it themselves. They had to actually spend man hours priming all those minis.
Well, it doesn't take long to prime. I mean, you don't have to coat the entire thing in primer. That's just funny, though. I just think that's hilarious, though.
Yeah.
I could see them all day with 10,000 minis laying out, and they got someone with one spray can trying to prime 10,000 miniatures. That's funny.
Yeah.
He lines them up on the table, and he takes a spray can, and he runs up and down.
Yeah, that's exactly. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was fun. I had a lot of fun. I look forward to going back next year. Actually, I'm going to help Reaper Brian organize the gaming next year because it was a little bit unorganized. And I said to him, why don't you do this? And he goes, you know what? Why don't you help? I said, all right, I will.
Yeah.
There you go. Get your brownie points.
Yep.
Yeah.
Get in for free.
Yeah, maybe I'll get in for free, right?
Yeah.
Well, you're a volunteer. You better get in for free.
Hell yeah.
That's what I tell anyone. If they want to get into a convention for free, if they can't afford it, volunteer.
Yeah, volunteer is a way to get in.
Or run in an event. Run a couple of events. Get in for free. Run the events. That's what conventions are hurting for, are people running events. If you get in there quick enough, run the events, get in for free.
And by the time this comes out, I'll be at North Texas RPG Con. That should be coming up this weekend, or if you're listening to it, it's probably already happening or has happened, depending on when Matt releases the show.
Yeah, because I was at Origins this past weekend, and I did a ton of interviews that I need to write up for a diehard game fan. Origins was really fun. I got to talk. I talked with Sean Fannin of DriveThruRPG. Talked to Chad with him for about 20 minutes. I talked with Ape Games, the people that make DuckDuckGo.
Yeah.
Yeah, I talked with them.
What was that again? What?
DuckDuckGo. It's actually like a racing game, but the figures are actually rubber, like little mini rubber ducks in different outfits.
It's so much fun.
Yeah, it's just like, you may not know the company's name, but I guarantee if you've been at a major convention, you've seen their booth with all the rubber ducks.
Duck, duck, go. Oh, I'll tell you.
Yeah. Let's see. Who else did I talk to? I had lunch with the line developer for Shadowrun Friday, and that was fun.
I heard they were doing another edition of Shadowrun again.
Latest version is the 20th anniversary edition, which is actually just the 4th edition rules cleaned up.
Right, I heard they were working on a new edition now.
He didn't say anything about that to me. When I asked him about it, he did say they are going to re-release the first edition setting of Shadowrun for 4th edition rules. So they're going to come out with a 2050 setting book with all the just with everything restatted for 4th.
Wow, that's kind of cool. I have my original first edition Shadowrun book, so let's play with the new rules. That would be kind of cool.
Yeah, so that's what they're working on. Then they released the Runner's Kit, which is like harkens back to the day of the old TSR box set with like a bunch of maps. It has cards for quickly generating NPCs. It comes with like some dry erase thing, player aids, and just it's just this neat little box of miscellaneous stuff that just adds so much to the gaming experience. And it actually won the Origin Award for Best RPG Supplemental Material. And they said that has taken off so well, they're going to be doing more player aid type stuff. They're actually going to, for since there's so many weapons in Shadowrun, they're actually going to come out with like a deck of cards. But it's all their weapons. Well, not all the weapons through all the books, but a good portion of some of the weapon catalogs. So that way, if you need to just see, this guy has a weapon, you just pull out the weapon card. Or if your player has a weapon, you can just physically hand them, this is your weapon. And it has all the stats on it.
Like they did with 2nd Edition, those little box set things that they had.
Right, right.
Box. Yeah, I remember those. That was cool.
Yeah, so they're going to be doing more of that because they discovered it's, for them, they were actually able to do the printing in the U.S. with that runner's kit.
Uh-huh.
So they were able to get it turned around quicker. They didn't have to worry about it sitting on a boat for 2 months.
Nice. Do they still own Earth Dawn, or is that long gone from their company?
I don't know if think they do. I don't think Earth Dawn's under Catalyst.
Oh, they went to Catalyst? Because I remember Earth Dawn was part of Shadowrun for the biggest time.
Right, yeah. Catalyst Game Labs took over the Shadowrun license from FanPro when there was some issues with FanPro. WizKids gave the license to Shadowrun. And same with Battletech. And then Catalyst is actually still licensing those licenses from Topps. So Topps actually still owns Battletech and Shadowrun, the properties.
Okay.
Yeah, my Earth Dawn books are all Fassa books.
Right. Yeah, I would assume Topps owns it because WizKids bought basically. Well, I don't know, actually. I don't know what happened when WizKids got Shadowrun, if they also got Earth Dawn and all the Fassa properties, or just Battletech and Shadowrun.
Wow.
So.
Now, the Shadowrun that you're talking about, the Shadowrun Returns?
No, that's the video game.
Okay, I thought that was the video game that, you know, that they pledged all that stuff on Kickstarter.
Right, that is, Shadowrun Returns is the video game, and they're hoping maybe that'll be an introduction to Shadowrun for a lot of players, kind of like the old SNES and Genesis games were.
Oh, right. Game.
I know, I actually asked him, is there any chance we could get that Joshua and that Sega Genesis game in like a module or book form? I want that. And he was like, oh, he kind of chuckled and was like, huh, that's not a bad idea.
That would be cool.
Yeah. I'm like, if I could get that, that'd be amazing.
A darn bomb in the head. Oh.
Yeah.
Anyway. So it's convention season. We got Gen Con coming up in August. I know I won't be there. Matt will be there.
Yep.
Will not be there, right?
No, I'm doing that every other year. That'll be next year.
Okay.
Now, unless Mr. Atkinson can talk me into it, we're supposed to be gaming with him sometime here in the near future, so we'll see how that works.
Well, good. Give him a pat on the back for me and try to get me a badge in there, too.
Okay, no problem.
I'm kidding. Okay. So, Will, are you still working on those mini tiles, the tiles that you're working on or not?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I posted about maybe 2 weeks ago, I believe it is. I posted that stuff on the website and everything. And what I did was I have all the floors done. Oh, I'm sorry, not the floors, but the hallways. The hallways are done. What I got to do is next, because when I looked at it, I said, you know, if I make rooms, I think that I'm going to use a different paint scheme for the room floors themselves, so you can see the difference between the hallway and the rooms. And so I'm working on that now.
Yeah, I remember seeing a post on OSR Gaming for that. You had actual little rooms laid out with the minis on the tiles and everything.
Yeah, that was just an example of what the rooms would look like. And when I looked at it, I said, you know what? This is not going to work. So what I'm going to do is I have the rooms already cut out. I use the D&D tiles that make my 20 by 20, my 60 by 60, my 50 by 50, and whatever the case may be. I already made those. So all I got to do is now it's just get a different paint scheme. I have to order another mold, which will help me with some of the cavern parts of the palace, because there's some cavern parts to it. And then I'll be getting started on that, as a matter of fact, this week, as you bring it up.
Cool.
So I'm hopefully to get this game started by August. I'm hoping to get it started by August. I got 6 people that volunteered to run through the entire thing. We're going to do the whole weekend. Take the whole weekend to do it.
No sleep? Just all game?
Well, we're going to do 8 hours one day, then 8 hours the next.
Wow.
And I that is one module that I am very confident that could be completed in 8 hours, to be honest with you.
You think so?
Well, the reason I say that, because as most people know and everything, and it's a good thing they don't listen to this podcast, I was at Le Mans, you know, all they have to do is find the 3 silver statues or find the harp. And I think that, what was that? Oh, and they find the sword. Once they find one of those 3 ways to destroy the red ruby crystal, the game's over. And when they go to the second floor, it's actually real easy to get to that throne room where that ruby crystal's at. So I'm really confident that this is a game that can be done in 8 hours. But if they don't, then the next day we have another 8 hours to get it done.
Cool.
It just depends on how they search the place. Now, if they find the stairs that go up and then decide to explore the entire top level before they find everything on the first level, well, then, yeah, that definitely is going to be a 2-day thing then.
All right, cool. So we'll have to, you know, post up on OSR Gaming in the forums how that's going to work out, because we definitely want to see that.
Oh, yes. I have some more posts that will be going up tonight after I finish playing my game tonight. I will be coming out and be posting reviews on UK2, UK3, and I think I'll have enough time to do UK4 and UK5 tonight too as well.
Cool. Yeah, cool. Nothing else. We can just head right into Sage Advice.
Master, they're at the gates again. Master! It looks like another band of adventurers!
Adventurers? Again? Always the same. Coming to me for sage advice.
Alright, so we're in Sage Advice here. We have a whole lot of emails to read, plus a voicemail, so we'll get to the voicemail first. We're going to take turns reading some letters and comment about them, and then we'll go to the topic to talk about in the show. But we wanted to do all the emails everybody's been writing in just to catch up and, you know, get everyone all caught back up together. So let's start with the voicemail.
Greetings, RFI gamers. This is DM Kojo calling. Hey, just wanted to thank you for another fantastic issue, number 83, about the planar travel. Loved it. Planar travel talk takes me back to the old days when we'd go hunting for gods, the Deities and Demigods book, in the different planes, and, you know, superpower gaming as 12-year-olds. Awesome. Just want to tell you, it's a great show. Also, love Nick's idea about not telling the players how their spells will work and magic items will work. I think if they've never been there, or even if they got info from somebody else, that the idea of them going to do a spell that they think is going to save their butts and then having it fizzle, I think that's a great role-play opportunity and a lot of fun. Keep up the good work. Talk to you later.
DM Kojo, an evil DM in the making.
Evil? I call that killer.
Ah, come on. It's fun to do that.
No, I think that's fair enough. I have no problems with that. That's just knowledge that wouldn't come out naturally to the players. Not all of them would know that kind of stuff.
Very true, and that's what makes the game so much fun, you know, not knowing what's going to happen ahead of time.
Yeah. Make your save and throw now. Why? What did I do? I just cast a spell. Yeah. Not make a save and throw.
Yeah. I hate that when people play adventures. They're like, oh, what about the staff? I was like, what are you doing in the adventure?
Yeah.
Guess what? The staff is gone now.
That's hilarious.
All right. So emails. Was it Will? You said you were going to take the first one?
Yeah. Actually, I said I was going to take the first 2 and everything because I kind of like, you know, got them a little littler and everything because one of them was almost a whole book. But we'll talk about that when we get to it and everything. I think the first email here, let me see here how I can read these things here. I'm trying to see where it's coming from. It's coming from, well, I don't know where. Oh, this is coming from Matt. So this is not our Matt. This is from Matt from someone else.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And he says here, hey, folks, I enjoyed your podcast very much. I was a big fan of the Forgotten Realms, but it seemed at some point in the late 90s, they seemed to abandon plain material in favor of historical material. They went a little overboard in terms of detail. And Eric Boyd did an admirable job, but I would have preferred some epic knight below-esque campaigns set in the realms. The high magic aspects of the realms can annoy some players, especially Greyhawk vets, but as the DM, you have control over all of that. Take what works and leave the rest.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah.
I believe that, yes.
Yeah, and there's still enough room in the realms that hasn't been charted out. You can make it happen.
Yeah, you know, it's funny when I hear this because a lot of people say, I don't like Forgotten Realms because it's so overpowered. I mean, it's only overpowered if you let it be overpowered. I see it as a high magic campaign setting. There's a lot of magicalness in the Forgotten Realms. But are the characters actually going to witness that kind of magic? I disagree. I don't think so.
No. Most player characters should never meet Elminster. Yet it seems like a lot of DMs think, well, Elminster needs to meet my players at some point. No, he doesn't. If anything, he would just wander in, like, oh, look at those silly adventures, and keep going. He wouldn't care.
What do we have first? We have that box set, correct? The one box set first edition?
Yeah, the city system, and we have the six FR 1 through 6 books.
Okay, so what you do is, if you want to avoid all this garbage, find an odd place in one of those books, a town, an odd place, and have your players start there. That way they're out of the way of everything.
Right.
And you can make your own rules over there.
And really, those books, they're not that high magic when compared to second edition.
No, not at all. And that's the best part about it. And, you know, it's funny when you bring up Elminster, and I'm thinking, like, why would Elminster care? I mean, really, he really wouldn't. I mean, he'd look at him and say, listen, you all are mortals. I have God in me, you know, because, of course, you know, he's a mixture of that. I mean, he does. Right. He's got some of that God blood in him. I mean, that's what he is. But, I mean, it's no different with any other campaign out there, like Lord of the Rings. You don't have to run into Gandalf and Frodo and all of them. If I was playing Lord of the Rings and ran into Frodo or any of them, I'd have killed them because I didn't like them. So, I mean, now how is this going to solve the ring? I'm going to kill him now. You know, no, I'm just messing around. I wouldn't do that. But no, you just take him out of the way. They don't have to run into any of the personalities. Same thing with Greyhawk. Are you going to run into Mordenkainen or Rigby or Bigby and the rest? No, you won't run into these guys.
Well, I think the problem with Forgotten Realms is, since there's so many novels and there's so much stuff out there, most players have read something and they expect to see that in their game.
Well, you know, that's a false assumption, my friend. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
If you pick a Forgotten Realms novel didn't have any big name in it, you'd probably be like, meh.
This is boring.
Yeah,
right.
That's because they have those names in it, because it's a novel. They want you to read it and buy it.
Oh, yeah. Well, hey, we got to run into Dritz, too. I want a Black Panther.
Yes. You walk into a tavern, and there's Dritz and Elminster sitting there having a drink together. I mean, that's what some players seem to expect.
That's what they expected. Then when it happens that night, they go onto their little blogs, they go on Facebook and say, guess who I met last night? I met Elminster. And I'm thinking, like, oh, one of these kinds.
No, then what you do is, it was actually someone pretending to be Elminster. It's actually like a villain who's using you.
Oh, or a doppelganger or something.
Yes, a doppelganger. It was just a doppelganger convention, and they just took the form of all the big names in Forgotten Realms.
Yeah, suckers. That's hilarious.
All right, cool.
But no, the guy, he's true, though. I mean, he's true. And, you know, like the epic, he talked about the Night Below-esque campaigns. You know, it is what it is and everything. You know, there's a lot of material. I wish they did add a little bit more to it. They just did their box set or whatever the case may be. But Night Below, wasn't that done by Bruce Cordell?
Yeah.
I thought Bruce Cordell did all that stuff. I thought he did all that.
Oh, he did, too. I think he did.
I'm going to have to take a look at that and everything. But, you know, hey, Bruce is still around. Send an email to Bruce. He's on Facebook and he's some other place there. Talk to Bruce, see what he got. And maybe he'll do something.
He's busy focusing on Mystara right now, isn't he?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, because I think he wants to get it relaunched in one shape or form.
I sat down with him for an interview for Save or Die, and he was mostly talking about Mystara and Hollow World. So I think he wants to get it relaunched again.
Hey, I have no problem with that because I like both those things.
Yeah, in fact, he was looking into, at the time, purchasing the trademark from Mystara.
Wow, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know what happened with that, so.
Yeah. I think that trademark's actually lapsed last time I checked.
It is lapsed, yeah.
Yeah, it is. That's from what it's last said online, it is lapsed, so.
Absolutely 10 years now.
Wow.
Wizards dropped it as soon as they even bought the whole company's thing. go to the next email. Well,
next one. Okay, the next email. Okay, let me see. Who is this from, though? Where's his name at on here? Oh, there is Tom. Okay, Tom, don't take this the wrong way. There's no way we can read this entire book, so I'm going to highlight some of the good important things that you were mentioning here. So it says here, hello there from sunny Kent, southeast UK, UK, United Kingdom, right?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, let's make sure. I was thinking of the UK modules. I said, which one is that one? And from the most haunted village in England, namely Pluckley. Is that how you say it? Pluckley?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that's most a weird name. Who would want to haunt a village named Pluckley? I tell you, that's weird.
It's haunted village in the UK.
I'm going to look that up because I never heard of that before, but that's good, though. Okay, here it goes. Guys, I got to say thanks very much for doing a really great job with the podcast. It's really good to hear people who are still obsessed with such a great game. Well, I don't know if I'm obsessed with the game, Tom, but I tell you, I just love the game.
Obsessed.
Are you all obsessed?
Yeah, you are too, Will. Too bad.
Okay. Well, here we go. First, let me say I've been listening to them a while. It's very common and almost therapeutic to listen to you guys while I work. They're bloody great, and you guys obviously have a great chemistry. I can't say I understand all the stuff you talk about. It goes over my head sometimes. What fascinates me is the seriousness you give to completely fantastical invented world and gaming system. It's extraordinary and taps into the old fascination I had with the game, as well as, fantasy role-playing games in general back in my early teens. I love the monster section particularly, and was amused to find that you could defeat a beholder with a standard room fan used for ventilation. Those mini gerbil men were hilarious too. Now I have no clue what he's talking about. This must be something early in the day. But as you continue on with your stuff and everything, I must say my favorite game was still basic D&D. If you haven't done it already, I'm still listening to podcasts from 2010. Oh, from 2010. Could I ask for a small examination of the basic rules on your show? Just as a small aside, I know it's not AD&E, but still, it's still part of the evolution. To be honest, it was always the artwork that hooked me to the edition I like the best. And he's talking about the Elmore paintings are still fantastic, and they still conjure up the magic that I felt when I first played. And he also likes the second edition AD&D revised black-covered books. Awesome. Anyway, I digress. Keep up the good work. I'm still listening. We'll continue to do so. If you could direct me to any old school games in Canterbury, Kent, in the United Kingdom, I would be much appreciative. And when I say old school, I mean D&D, AD&D, Traveller, and Star Wars. From an old schooler with his head still in the clouds, I raise my glass to you and say cheers. And may all your hits be crits. Tom.
Yeah, I don't know what the Beholder thing was. Matt, do you remember that at all?
I don't either. I'm trying to remember what that would be. I guess it would have something to do with, like, the levitation of a Beholder or something, and how if you had a strong gust of wind, you could blow it away or something?
I think that's what it was about.
Playing around with it at the time, because you'd like to do, like, the whole, you know, the angle of the air and stuff like that, you know, how he did that stuff.
Right. So there's probably some way you can mess with its levitation by changing the air, at which point you're just hurtling it down a hallway or something because of airflow.
That's hilarious. I got to check into that. That's just obviously funny.
Our forums, osrgaming.org, there's quite a few people from the UK over there that could probably direct you to old school gaming. And as far as basic D&D, listen to the Save or Die podcast. That's D&D there.
Yes, that's a good one for the second edition if he wants to listen to that. And, you know, I have no problem covering the basic edition, which he's talking about Mensa, the red box.
That's covered on Save or Die.
That's covered on Save or Die and all those and everything. Yeah, like you said, if they have questions, they can ask on here and we can cover it real quick. Like, I don't have no problem with that.
Right, I generally prefer to direct it to Save or Die so we can keep the two separate, that's all. Yeah.
No, it's all good. And like I said, you know, Tom, no, I appreciate the long email. I wish I could have read the entire thing. It was very good. And like I said, just, you know, get those questions to us and we will answer anything. But mostly if it's first edition, hey, talk to us.
Yep. And he also wanted to give a shout out to the London Gaming Meetup that play at the Ship's Pub near the London Bridge on Saturday afternoons, yeah. Too. So shout out to those that play at the Ship's Pub.
It was just so much to read that, you know, Will had to just summarize some of it.
Oh, yeah. Otherwise, this podcast would have been 2 hours long. No, I'm just joking, Tom. It wouldn't have been that long. But, no, that's all good, though.
All right. I'll grab you on number three, which comes from DM Dell. He's a new listener. First time writing the show. Been catching up on the older episodes. When listening to issue 10, so he's way back there on issues. So he's curious. A couple items that came up, he's asking. He said DM Vince stated that he had a group of low-level characters find and use scrolls, but their party only consists of a fighter, a monk, and a thief. I was wondering if I missed a rule for this somewhere. I consulted the books and found only spell scrolls usable like class by protection scrolls only. Well, a thief at a certain point can read scrolls as part of their class. Isn't there a certain percent chance to do that?
Yeah, I thought they had a read magic percentage at some point.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure about that. And I believe thieves can use that. I don't have a book in front of me right now. You want to look that up. Yeah. And secondly, I'm having trouble putting a price to spell scrolls and potions in my game as well. Where to get them? Not every general store stocks such items, as you know. The players always want to purchase them before they enter dungeons, which is smart, especially if there are no clerics or mages. Definitely smart. Is there a piled list I am missing somewhere in the books? Thanks for helping with the great work, DM Dell. No, there's no list in any of the books, really. But what you could do is you can make up your own store ahead of time with prices. You whatever you see fit. I mean, if you want the players to be in a town that rarely has magical items, you can jack up the price. I think Gary even says in the book the prices in the book are not to be used in standard towns. It's just a standard list. Make right. whatever you want. Because generally certain things won't be available everywhere.
But yeah.
Since I would definitely kind of jack them up a little bit. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, Will.
Oh, okay. No, no. No, I just wanted to cover a little bit that question he covered on like we talked about the thieves. I believe they have to be at least 10th level. And they're allowed to decipher magical writings and utilize scrolls of all sorts, excluding those of clerical, but not druidic. So they can't use druid scrolls or spells of that nature.
Yeah, and there is, however, a 25% chance that the writing will be misunderstood, too, mm-hmm. since they're not fully trained in the use of magic. So
right,
but
in that turn, that would make that means that if they cast a spell and they fail, it might be the reverse.
True, and maybe this could have been, I don't know the situation exactly from issue number 10. But this could have been a DM Joe game, and if that's the case, DM Joe liked screwing with us. So he had a rule that any player can read a scroll. So, because he used to like to just, you know, mess with the outcomes of everything. So,
could have been.
Yeah. It also says, though, furthermore, magic spells from scrolls can be mispronounced when uttered, so that there is an increasing chance per level that it will be reversed of its intent.
Yeah.
So that misunderstood isn't the same as the mispronunciation. But they actually don't give any rules for determining that mispronunciation, so I guess that's a right. DM fiat there.
Look what happened to Bruce Campbell.
Yeah.
But he said Klaatu Verata.
Very true.
He failed memorization.
But like I said, now, and in this case here, and you know, when Vince has a game like a fighter, a monk, and a thief, if that's the only characters in the party, I could see where there, you know, there might be a scrolls that would be available for them to use. I think fighters could only use protection spells, though. I know he's correct on that part, the fighters and so on. But thieves can use them all except druidic spells. Didn't they say they excluded the clerical ones?
Yeah, I think that's what you said.
But not druidic.
Oh, not druidic, though. Okay.
So, no cleric spells, but you get all your nature.
No clerics, but they get the druid ones. That's what I meant. I said it backwards. I'm sorry. They couldn't be worded that different.
What?
They can't cast clerical spells, but they can cast druidic spells.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I said it backwards.
Oh, okay.
And as far as getting scrolls, I mean, I don't have magic shops in my campaigns.
Well, how do people get magic potions?
Well, they make them.
Well, you don't have like a general store, like in the general store, the guy would have like one or two healing potions as a special price or something.
Well, I mean, they can go to a temple to get a healing potions and stuff like that. Or, you know, I would just send them to places like that if they really need it. And if this is really to assist the party and they're really suffering on healing, yeah, I would have the clerk, yeah. You know, go down to the temple and maybe donate a lot of money to get the potions and whatnot.
Yeah, because really, if you think about it, there's quite a bit of effort in constructing just a basic Cure Light Wounds healing potion. So it's not even going to be at a general store, because they would have had to spend lots of gold just to get that, because I don't see the magic user or the cleric that spent all that time and effort making it.
What are you talking about? An alchemist.
I'm thinking of if they were to actually create it using the rules in the book.
No, you just go an alchemist store. Alchemist.
You're treating the healing potions as more alchemy based. I was treating them more like it's only clerics and magic users making them.
Oh, okay. I usually treat it as an alchemist making, because I wouldn't think a cleric or a magic user would waste their time, personally.
Right. Yeah, I can see that.
It all depends on everything.
Yeah, it just depends on your setting, if you want to have alchemists brewing those type of mundane potions, or if you want to go just strictly by the book, and the only way people that are able to make it by the rules is your magic users and your clerics.
I see the alchemist in my campaign settings is with this big elaborate setting in the back of their store, manufacturing like they were doing a microbrewery of beer.
Okay.
And then it's just that abundant.
Yeah.
It's a little store and buy beer. It's kind of not cheap, but cheap.
Right.
That's how I base some of the potions on. If it's a D6, like, you know what, 20 gold pieces or something, or not even that much sometimes.
Okay.
That's how I kind of base things. I'm thinking of it that way.
Yeah.
To each their own.
Yes. That will work.
Yep.
All right. So next email, 4. This comes from DM Grimscythe or Scythe. So yeah, something like that. I'm a dungeon master down here in Florida who's a DM for a few amateur groups. What's an amateur group?
Newbies.
Yeah, okay. I always find that in a beginner group, there's always a few players who assume that all the adventures come from the old man in the rocking chair, or the kindly bartender, or even the shadow figure in the corner.
The shadow?
So, gotta quote gamers on that one.
Yep.
So I have found a fun way to counter these guys. Whenever they enter a tavern, there's a man sitting in the shadowiest corner with his hood pulled up, his feet propped up on the table, and an untouched beer in front of him. This guy is a dummy set up by the tavern master to mess with the newbies in their town.
That's awesome.
I love this. She's actually go and talk to him. He does not respond. If the PCs tap him on the shoulder or engage with him physically, his pumpkin head will fall off, and the whole tavern goes into laughs or fits. Laughing fits. I can't read. I love this method of bringing in new players to the game. It gives them a touch of humor that they can go into the game and lets them know not everything is exactly what you expect. Now, they've given you a bit of my fun stuff to do. I would like to ask a question. Excuse me. In my least experienced group of players, we have two players that are playing a cleric and a paladin. They are both male and female. This came up before, but we'll do it again. They are both males, and they play female characters. Little smiley face with a tongue sticking out there.
That's funny.
Being inexperienced players that they are, every time we encounter any type of male antagonist, everything from a shopkeep to a kobold, ew. They attempt to seduce the opponent. Seduce a couple? Hey, give me some of that lizard beak. It annoys me because they spend too much time trying to seduce their enemy and absorb as much of any kind of serious storytelling that can happen. I've expressed my annoyance towards them but they continue to annoy me. Can you give me advice how to stop this? Thank you. Blah, blah, blah.
Well, my first suggestion would be, they make disease rules for a reason. Use them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The second thing is what we used to do in my group, some people used to play girls, was when they start doing it, you go, really, dude? Come on. You're a dude.
Right. Watch the Gamers 2 Darkness Rising. They had a male actor playing the female elf that Jen Page played. So it was between Jen and this other actor. They were alternating the female role. And he would constantly start flirting on with the female characters, even though he was a girl in-game.
Yeah.
So they handled that rather amusing. Just be like, would you really be doing that?
Yeah, I've done it plenty of times where we're like, dude, listen. All right, I understand you're playing a girl. Enough. You're a dude. It's getting a little creepy now.
Right. Either that, or you just accept the fact maybe they don't want a super serious game. They want something like silly, goofy, and wacky, and just go with that. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is my thing. Oh, man, I tell you. Newbies are funny. You know what I would do? Play Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Don't play D&D anymore with this group. That's what they need to do. If they want to seduce things, play a Buffy the Vampire game or play Twilight game or something like that. They could do all the seducing they want to and everything, you know, and then we'll be good to go on that. But, I mean, you're going to have to pull them to the side and let them know, hey, listen, we want to play D&D. Let's get a little serious and everything. Let's play the game that it was meant to be.
Don't be too serious. Just knock off the flirting. That's all.
Well, I'd look at it like this, though, and you know what? Especially a cleric and a paladin. You're more concerned with going around stomping. I don't know what their alignments are. Hopefully the paladin's lawful good. If the paladin's not lawful good, there's something wrong. Then that bad boy's got his, or she's got her priorities in the wrong place.
Right.
She needs to go out there and kill some monsters. This seducing stuff? Nah. That's got no time for that.
I got a great idea. Reduce it to a game mechanic. He says, he starts to tingle. Okay, great. Oh, from now on, just say seduce. Take a roll versus the charisma. Nope, doesn't work. End of story.
Right.
There goes. I like that.
Yeah.
And just make it not work every time.
Right. Or maybe depending on what they're trying to seduce, let's see how far you can take them down the rat hole with this. And then there's some fun things you can do, hence the disease tables. Or perhaps this would really depend on the group you're playing with. Your cleric, she's pregnant out of wedlock.
Oh,
yeah, I'm not.
I would rather paladin be pregnant out of wedlock. You can't wear plate mail armor anymore.
Yes, not yet. Very true. Right.
There was a good example of. Never mind.
Right. Yeah, well, yeah, we can just go down this rat hole and just get up in a very bad place. Hence why you shouldn't be seducing kobolds in a game.
Kobolds, of all things.
Just reduce it to a game mechanic. If they start going seducing, go, okay, great. Have them do a 3d6 versus charisma. Jack it up so high that they can't even get it. And be like, oh, I'm sorry, you failed.
Right.
Move on. That's it. That's the way to take care of those players. Email number 5. Matt, you want to summarize that one from... we scroll down. Yeah. Daniel, who actually has 2 emails.
Yep, so... This is from Daniel in issue 33 about magic users. You discussed the use of magic users and some of the other things they can do to support the party more than just casting spells. He says, as a DM, he likes to separate the type of research that the magic user can provide for a party, then have that be different than a cleric. So basically, it's like he starts talking about having the magic user, since they do so much studying, spend so much time with books, actually having them... giving them more knowledge than just, like, straight arcane. Maybe they know more history, or they know more about this specific city because they've researched it for spells or whatever, since they spend so much time in libraries and books researching. So kind of sounds like he's talking about making the magic user a magic user with a bit of a sage to him. Mm. Then because he says, like, the magic user knowledge is extremely valuable because it provides, like, the background history that the adventure begins with. So he actually uses it as a way to kickstart the campaign because this magic user knows all of this stuff. And he actually brings up magic users have greater access to city records, libraries, private libraries, scholars that your typical fighter wouldn't have, or your thief wouldn't be interested in unless he could actually sell them at a market. And then with the cleric, he's talking about giving them more knowledge in the, like, divine or esoteric, since they deal with their deities. Kind of like how when we were discussing the astral and ethereal planes, how to give characters just some knowledge about the planes, and having the ethereal be more divine-based. And I suggested, like, having the clerics know a little bit about that, so that way the players don't really get hosed if they have to go there. And same with the astral. Have the magic user... know a little bit about that, since magic users tend to use that for travel. And he also talks about using the thief for just gathering information about locales. Really, he talks a lot about ways to give background knowledge to the characters starting out, which is something I actually usually do in my games. It's like, okay, you're from this area, so you would know all of these things. You as a player may not, but when they come up in the game, I'm going to say, yeah, you will know who the mayor of this town is because you're from it. You don't need to spell all of that out beforehand. It's just stuff you assume they know. And then, yeah, so he just ends, let's not forget that the magic user is more than just the sum of his spells, which is so very true. And personally, that he prefers magic users to offer the background and research. Then it allows me as the DM to always be the one offering the narrative or information. So instead of him having to feed the background story, he has the players feed it to the other players. So you have a little bit of a filter in that can be interesting. And then he just says, thanks from all your fans on your dedication to this craft. It's wonderfully entertaining to hear you guys week after week. From Daniel. So, well,
yeah. There's more after this, too.
Oh, yes. And then we go to his second email. He says, notice that you are discussing MSPs are being disrupted from casting spells during combat. That is virtually just being touched or jostled to allow for the spell to be disrupted. He says that it seems too easy. Therefore, my game, at least one point of damage has to be successfully made against the magic user in order for his spell to be disrupted. Although the next part is just house rule, I also allow him to overcome the damage with combat casting, assumed to be gained by leveling and adventuring experience. A damaged magic user can still get his spells off despite being damaged under the following formula, which I'll put in the show notes. When the spell is complete, if he's been damaged anyway, you must roll less than his level on a d20. If successful, you can gain a save versus paralyzation to complete the skill with a negative modifier equal to the combined damage received from all the sources at the time the spell is complete. So basically, roll a d20, roll under your level, but you have a penalty equal to however many points of damage you took during that round. So it's all not guaranteed. It still gives young, inexperienced mages a chance to pull off spells, even if it's not likely, and it rewards mages who level and gain greater experience, so they kind of know how to cast in a combat situation, or if, oh, I'm hit, but can still have enough control that they're able to pull the spells off. So, I don't know. It's interesting because it all depends on your take in magic. Is magic this hyper complex thing where if you're off even like a millimeter on your hand waving or the timing of your words, will the spell not work? Or is it more forgiving in that if you're as long as you put the right amount of effort in, it'll work?
Well, I mean, let me start with his first email, which is, you know what? That was an excellent email, and I really like that because now this is a DM who wants characters to take bigger roles than what is generally stated in the player's handbook. And to be honest, there ain't too much in the player's handbook concerning what is an actual character's role. What does a cleric know? What does a magic user know? What does a thief? And so on and so on and so on. And he hit it right on the head. I really think that was an awesome email. And I agree that when you have a magic user, I mean, it isn't that he just knows what's in his spell book and that's it. I think he should be, you know, I'm not saying an expert, but he should have some knowledge of other related arcane issues, whether it's dealing with the planes or dealing with magical monsters. If a monster is magical in nature, I have no doubt that the magic user might know about it or heard something about it, maybe studied something about it. Not all, more the common magical creatures, but not more the rarer ones. Same thing with clerics. I would be certain to agree that when clerics go through their studies, they're learning about the nine hells. They're learning about the 606 layers of the abyss. They're learning their foes, which happens to be demons and devils and all the other, you know, disgusting things that worship evil gods and foes of his or her god. So yes, I do agree that clerics and magic users would have more information that is generally indicated in the player's handbook. Same thing with thieves. Thieves in a city, depending on what city. You would probably know about thieves, guilds, and all that stuff. So, yes, I agree with that. Ooh. Now, the other one with the spells, on the spell casting, I play by the book. The book is very specific. If you take damage, your spell gets disrupted. I believe that was the example they used in there of a magic user trying to cast a spell. If he gets hit by an arrow, the spell is disrupted. Now, depending if the spell requires a verbal or somatic or whatever the case may be, that's going to depend on the issue right there. For example, if you grab somebody and you hold his arms down, but the spell only requires a verbal, that spell can still go off. Okay. However, if the spell requires somatic components as part of the spell to go off, and you're holding his arm down, he's being grappled, or he's bound, or whatever the case may be, then yes, the spell will be disrupted.
Right. And I would even say with verbal, if you get startled, your spell isn't going to work. Because,
yeah, exactly.
Or if you take a point of damage, because if you got poked with a dagger for one hit points, you're going to go ow. So if you're in the middle of casting a spell, Bawi Brana ow doesn't work.
So. Yeah, that's when the spell becomes, you know, reversed and back on the spellcaster.
Exactly.
Because he mispronounced it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he added an extra verbal component.
Right.
I shouldn't be giving no ideas like that, because then I'm the bad guy here now.
Yeah.
Bad. And that applies also, I guess, you know, with you know to anything like that. No, that excellent emails. I thought that was pretty good. Let us know what you do with that.
Yeah, definitely.
But I will tell you this though, I saw the thing where he brought up that combat cast and stuff and everything. This guy's been playing some 3.0, 3.5.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking too when I saw that. I'm like, combat cast? Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that, because you know what? If you're going to add that, and I see nothing wrong with that at all, if that makes your game much more interesting and it gives the character more of a punch. I mean, let's face it. He gets stabbed with a dagger, so your spell is going to fail automatically. Yeah, he might have to make a saving throw or whatever kind of roll you want to make if he gets stabbed to see if his spell still goes off. Yeah, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. If that makes your game fun, I have no problem with that whatsoever.
But I also see the just taking any damage kind of helps balance out very high-level magic users.
Oh, certainly so. Definitely.
Right. So if you're looking down at a 15th-level magic user about ready to cast Fireball on your entire party, guess what? You need to make sure that arrow hits.
So everything's arrows.
Right. But yeah. So as long as you can get that one shot off, it'll actually add quite a bit of drama, just knowing if I hit this, I stop the spell that's going to kill us all.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you know what? You better have a magic user that know how to cast magic missile. That is the whole thing with magic missile.
Yeah.
Always hits its target unless you're wearing that brooch of shielding or whatever the shield spell or whatever those spells do. But hey, I'm just telling you right now, always have magic missile ready to go.
Right. It's the ultimate spellcaster disruptor.
Exactly. No doubt.
Okay. The last email comes from John, who actually wrote another email after this, after I posted in the notes. Found your podcast. Love it. I recently started playing first and second edition again. I wanted to run a game for my group honoring Gygax, running the Temple of Elemental Evil. Aw, how nice. I want to use Gygax only, Gygax. I like this. I wanted to use Gygax only and Gygax approved books only. Books like Dungeoneer, Survival Guide, and Wilderness and Greyhawk Adventures all call me after the TSR fiasco. Not true. But were some of those approved by Gary, considering some of those were close friends that worked on them? Sorry for the oddball questions, but really wanted to play a dedicated game like game to the man who brought us so many years of fun, John. No, these were around before the fiasco, and even though Gary was gone by, what, 86, 87?
Yeah, it was like 87, 86, 87, yeah.
These were still in the works, so he approved these books.
Yeah. Yeah, just because they weren't published doesn't mean they weren't already under development when Gary. So if anything, pretty much published in 87 after he left, he actually approved because he was with the company during their development.
Right. And to play a true Gygaxian game, I would take the three core books, maybe the Monster Manual and the Fiend Folio, just use those, and that's the end of it. And then he followed up with, well, what about weapon speed and modifiers and psionics? Well, Gary never liked either one of those two things, and he was kind of forced into putting those into the book by I think was the original was by the Bloom Brothers, and the other one was by Dave Arneson. So
yeah,
he never played with those rules. So basically, I wrote them back, and I just summed it up. Just use basic D&D rules.
Right.
Yeah.
Or declare what they're doing. Roll a d6, highest side wins. Spells go off first, then missile attack, and then melee attack. That's all. Just do that. Yep. Just make it simple.
Yeah, if you want to do the Temple of Elemental Evil, you're gonna need psionics. You're gonna have it.
Oh, is it? I never really went through the.
Oh, there's psionic creatures in there. Oh yes, you better believe it.
They're just gonna have to have psionics then.
They better have something. Well, I mean, the player characters don't naturally have to have psionics. But I'm certain there. I don't know if there was two creatures in there that do actually have psionic abilities. And I tell you right now, they're gonna. I don't think.
And it's very hard to say what would be truly a Gygaxian adventure because as Gary grew older, his rules changed so much from what I've read and what I've seen. And I'm sure, Will, you've probably seen the game of him playing it, or Matt, you've probably seen the game.
Oh, yes.
And you probably went, I don't remember that.
Right. Yeah.
As he got older, I think he got really lax with rules and just went, meh, whatever works, works.
Right. He evolved. He didn't... over time, he wasn't set in his ways like so many people want to make it. It's not like he came from high upon the mountain with these rules written in stone and they never changed. He actually evolved his own rule set over time that he used in his own game.
That's right. And Dave was the same way. He evolved his rule sets. And I said, like, this is weird. This is what it says in the book. But who's going to argue with the master, right?
Right.
No, I love to see what Dave would have done with Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, and I've seen a copy of it. The Fantasy Rules RPG, and I think Dave was a little nuts with his formulas. That's all I have to say. Had way too many math formulas in there, and I went, huh? If things were like take this, add this, divide it by
that. That's a war gamer.
And that's the whole point about it. If you really want to play a true Gygaxian game, go to miniature gaming, historical miniature gaming. That's true Gygaxian.
Play chainmail or something like that.
Yeah, go to that side of the house and everything. Go to that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the emails, rfistaff@gmail.com. Or you can call 570-865-4210, the hotline. Talk as long as you want. Leave a voicemail. We appreciate it, and we're going to head over to our segment of Table Manners.
Yeah, I remember back in the day, a fella knew how to judge a fireball on the fly and how far the cleric could push the undead he turned. I tell you, with all these min-maxers and munchkins, metagame and power game, there's something missing that I'm here to learn you. Now sit down and crack your book while I commence to teach you some.
Table Manners.
Okay, so we're at Table Manners, and this is a question that's been brought up a couple times I've seen on the forums. People have asked me, and we've done this in the past, how to design and play a dragonborn or a half-dragon type character. Now, have any of you guys done this at all in your campaigns?
No, I haven't.
Well, I've done it in my campaign. Will, have you done it at all?
Oh, no. You're going to stick with the natural races. No dragonborn.
Well, when you get bored, sometimes you tend to tend to want to... yeah, characters get bored, so they want to change themselves. They tend to want to play something different. And in my campaigns, as long as a player can justify something with me and they take the time and effort to write it out and draw it out, I will probably allow it because I think, you know, if you can take that much work and dedication, let's try it. So we came up with, I remember, still to this day, it was called the Star Trek Klingon style race. Basically, think of the original Star Trek series, the Klingons, how they look like humans, just slapped on beards and skin colors, and it was like, that's a Klingon? Looks like a human. So that's what we did. We decided that for every good thing your character gets, you have to have a bad, stupid thing about them. So if you wanted to play a dragon, half-dragon character who had good strength, you had to have a reason for that good strength and also a bad thing about it. So you had big strength, so that means you had really large arms or something. Or if you wanted to have a breath weapon, which was 1d6 is what we allowed, you had to have your lips look different and you had a pierced tongue, like a lizard tongue. Or had special eyes. Or one guy actually... wanted to have, he's like, I want wings. I don't want anything else. I just want wings. So we decided, okay, how are we going to explain this? So now he has dragon wings so he can fly around. But how are you going to hide this? So he came concocted this whole thing of he's going to get monk robes, extra long, and a hump on the back, and he's going to have a cane and lean all forward, and he's going to pretend like he's a crippled old man wandering around with his cane, but yet he's keep he walk fine. So, I mean, he drew it out and showed me how it would look because he was an artist. And we plotted the whole thing. And from a DM point of view, I went, all right, that's possible. That might work. Some people might question it. And I rolled to see if people would check it out. But it's possible. So that's how we did that.
Yeah. I mean, I start thinking about, like, the Draconians from Dragonlance when I think Dragonborn. And something, if you want to give them some more powers or whatever, perhaps you steal something from the Draconians that players hate. The once they reach zero hit points, they blow up or turn to stone. So all of a sudden, combat's a lot scarier because if you drop to zero, you're not coming back at all. So if you perhaps something like that. So yeah, you can exist, but you may if you hit zero, you're gone. So none of this negative constitution or negative hit points. Zero hit points, you're done. And you may blow up and deal damage to everyone else, all your friends next to you.
There's also a great supplement, and RollAids made it, Dragons. It doesn't really talk about dragon-born characters or half-dragons, but it does do dragons as player characters, so you can reference how to make a dragon-type player character. It has a chart here, and they go by molting stages, which would be like years the dragon is, and you have... Mm-hmm. First 50 years and the first next 50 years for 51 to 150, 151 to 300. But each stage you roll and there's a different thing that you would do. You increase this and do that. You have an experience chart. First level to second level, 4,000 experience points.
Wow.
Been there quite a while. This book is the most detailed book I've ever seen about an ecology of a dragon. If you can you flip into this book... It's got the biology of a dragon. It shows the skeletal structure of a dragon, the insides of a dragon, what is where its heart is, what it looks like, how its bones look, hollow bones, its pseudo lungs, how the dragon wings look exactly. They go into how each dragon is a part of clans. So they're not just silver, black, red, green. They actually have clans inside the dragons that dictate how they act. And then they actually go to one class in this book called the Dragon Lords. And those are basically just think of the movie Aragon, the Dragon Riders.
Yeah.
If you ever see Dragon Lords, yeah, here it is.
Right.
And it just tells you there's different types of it. The Dragon Lords is the power one. There's the bard type one. There's a priest one. There's a magic user one. There's a lot of really good information here. Plus it has a little adventure in the back so you can use it all. Good book. I recommend anyone pick it up.
Dragonborn, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, see, when I think of Dragonborn, I think of, you know, some other places like, Dark Sun, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because in that game, it's kind of weird because the people that that go the way of the dragon, and they'll eventually turn into one. And that's what the Sorcerer Kings did. They would turn into, their final form would be that of a dragon. And, you know, they would assume that the scaly aspect and all the weird little things start happening where they start turning more lizard-like. Whereas, you know, the good clerics, the preservers and everything, they turn themselves into the Evangeons, which is like some type of angelic butterfly-looking thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you had him in Eberron. So I saw, I seen Dragonborn quite a bit. And then you had the Saurian race from 2nd edition. You remember those bad boys?
Yeah.
What was that guy's name? Dragonbait?
I don't remember, honestly.
I think that was named Dragonbait. So, I mean, there are some Saurial races. I mean, they're not related to dragons specifically. But if anything, I'll probably play Kobold. They're more related to dragons than anything else.
Think so?
Oh, they are.
Yeah.
Y'all know that?
No, I don't really consider kobolds like dragons myself.
Oh, you don't consider them lizard-like instead of the dog-like?
I
Unfortunately, I always go the Liz route and think puppies.
Yeah, I know they're actually lizard-like to be dragon-like, but I've always thought them, like Liz and Save or Die always says puppies, little dogs, little bears, whatever.
Yeah, that is weird.
I've always thought of it that way, kind of.
Yeah, well, I'm just going with, you know, later editions of D&D, they actually state that, you know, that kobolds are descendant of dragons, and, you know, dragons don't like that at all one bit, just thinking that they're being related to a kobold. Nope. But, I mean, there was another supplement that allowed you to play Dragonborn. What was it called again?
Dragonborn? Eberron?
No. There was a box set where you could actually play a dragon being from second edition, but I can't remember what it was called again.
Let's see.
Oh, you all know what it is. Come on now.
Let's see. There's
Council of Worms?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
That was what it was. It took me a second to think. It was the Council of Worms. That's why I remember this. So again, we're going back on the subject. If you allow people to play those kind of races. Now that one there, I believe you can assume the Dragonborn you're talking about, Vince, is the same one from the Council of Worms, where if you want to be like a copper-like or a gold or a black or a green, red and blue.
Yeah.
Oh, they do. Okay, good to go. Okay, I'll just make sure.
Yeah, this is the Dragon's Book by Rollins. It actually shows you how to create your own dragon as a player character. It actually has...
Oh!
Let me flip back in here. It has a strength chart. It shows you how to... For strength, roll 4d6 plus 1 per molting, which if you read it, it tells you what to do. Intellect, 3d6. Stamina, 4d6. Dexterity. Appeal. And there's something called Ego, which they invented. And Ego... let's see. Whenever a dragon goes into combat or tests his will with another dragon creature, the dragon must make a saving throw versus his ego. If he fails this roll, the dragon will seek to lie, cheat, or run away from the combat of test of wills. So even good and willful dragons will find it hard not to try to cheat their opponents, backstab. So basically, it's a new little statistic they came up with to help with combat with dragons.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of interesting. They have really a lot of dragons: spectral, copper, black, brassine, blue, white, bronze. It goes on and on and on. Gold, green, silver. Pretty much whatever. It says pretty much whatever color you can think of, you can do. And the dragons all part different clans. So, an excellent book.
No, I think that's good to go and everything. And like I said, with second edition, I definitely would allow it in second edition, probably just to one person maybe. And I'm a firm believer that even in second edition, when they released the humanoid race book and all that other stuff that they released, that the monsters in general, well, I'm just making it plain and simple. Whether it's a dragonborn, whether it's a goblin, or whether it's a kobold or an orc, they could be of different alignments because they allow players to play them then.
True.
So yeah, they would run into dragonborn.
Definitely. I would allow it in the game as long as, like I said, a player can justify it and make it fit in the game.
Yeah, they would have to have a good storyline on that, though.
Well, I think if a player takes the time to write something up and draw it out, I think that's good enough for me, because anybody that gets that enthusiastic about a game should be rewarded. I know you wouldn't, Will, because you don't think that's enough, but...
that's enough. No, it is enough. Yeah, it is. You're being mean to me. But that's okay, though. I'm all right, though. I got over it. But no. You know, when it comes to first edition, I'm strictly by the book in first edition. And those anomalies would definitely come out in second edition. Those anomalies would, you know. Well, then again, you had Dragonlance, too.
Well, coming from my former group where I was lucky I got one line, a sentence for background, you know, anything is better.
Well, I always encourage gamers, if they're going to play stuff, any type of race that's non-canon with the book, well, not non-canon, but, you know, it's not the writing by the book. I would just tell you, I want a story. Why do you want to play a Dragonborn? Give me his history. Why do you want to adventure? Well, yeah, I would do that, and I would, you know, get it in there somehow, one way or another.
Yeah. I'm the same way. If you can give me a good explanation as to why this anomaly exists, I'll run with it. Because usually you can make some pretty interesting stories just off of why they exist. And and you can also, perhaps off that background, develop some villains or that actually – kind of balance out any extra powers they may get from being this oddball race. So, yeah, you have this, like, you can fly or you have a dragon breath or something. But at the same time, now all of a sudden you're being hunted down by these other dragons who don't like you hanging out with, like, the humans and elves. Or, I mean, there's so much that can be done that's not even mechanical, just story-wise, that can balance out some of the mechanical aspects they may gain.
Right, right. Yeah, the breath weapon thing is actually, you know, just make them like the drow elves from the Unearthed Arcana. You know, they got their innate special abilities. The Dragonborn, of course, will have their special innate abilities and everything. Definitely have to keep that stuff in check. You don't want to be too powerful, though.
Right, but, like, would you give them natural armor? Or would,
yeah. Like, for every good thing, you always have to have something bad. So.
Right.
Yeah, if they have natural armor, they should not be allowed to wear regular armor.
Right, they have to have their special Dragonborn armor to fit over top of it, because most armor isn't made to work with scales.
Yeah, definitely so. You know, that's the joke of the town now. You see a Dragonborn running around wearing, you know, full plate, and the next thing you know, you hear that Teenage Ninja Mutant Turtles song going on and everything. You know, I mean...
Oroku Saki.
No, and then, you know, yeah, so that's the big thing. Can they be spellcasters, or would they be more prone to be spellcasters because if they're related to dragons, they have that magical blood flowing through their veins, you know, all that stuff, you know.
Right, and it's, would you let them even be certain classes? Would you let them be, like, a druid? Would you let them be a cleric? Or would you require them to be a cleric of a specific alignment, depending on which dragon they are?
Right.
Yeah, or awesome. I'm just trying to imagine, like, a dragonborn thief. For some reason, I don't see the dragonborn body being that conducive to being sneaky and nimble.
No, not at all.
No.
Like, fighters and maybe clerics or...
Right. Especially with the... if they decided to take claws as, like, a natural attack, you're not going to be disabling traps and picking locks with giant-ass nails.
Well, you could use your one little nail to pop the trap, you know.
True.
Use the tail. You use the tail if they have a long tail.
Oh, yes. Use the tail as the 10-foot pole.
No. Like I said, it all depends on the DMs and everything. And like I said, it also depends on the players and how they want to play one and everything. I mean, they can use – and I think y'all mentioned this before earlier in the podcast about using Draconians as a template.
You could do that, yeah.
Yeah, but I wouldn't have them blow up when they die or turn into a pool of acid or whatever they do.
That's funny.
Boom.
There goes the character. Give me a sheet.
One of them did explode, didn't they?
Oh, a lot of them did. One of them turns to stone. Another one blows up. Another one turns into a pool of acid. Just putting that in there will change the dynamic of the game some. Because they're now worried about ever even getting close to zero hit points.
Right.
Whereas most characters, okay, as long as I don't take massive damage and drop way into the negatives, I'll be okay. Dragonborn, if I even get close to zero, I'm like, nope, not going out anymore. Not until I get healed. Otherwise, yeah. I'm gone. With no hope of resurrection or... being revived in any way, shape, or form. Unless, of course, you wanted to, like, wish upon the ashes. But
yeah, I think that's a good thing right there. Yeah, especially with the hit points, yeah. If you go below zero, you're dead.
Yeah. Yeah, yep. That would be a way, if they wanted to play with a bunch of, like, the natural weapons, they wanted the armor, they wanted all that. Okay, yeah, you're all this, but at zero hit points, you blow up. You're with no chance of revival.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Especially at first level when you have few hit points.
Oh, man. Yeah. What's your class? Oh, I'm a mage. Oh, wow. You only have 5 hit points? Oh,
watch out for that sling. Oh, that'd be something. Just have one as a companion NPC and they just get hit by a 5-year-old throwing a rock and they blow up.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That works. All right. Well, I guess that's all we can really say about that. Anyone else have any last comments about it?
Oh, no, I'm good.
Yeah.
You're all good in the hood?
I'm all good in the hood.
Yeah. All right, well, that's the show for this week. We spent too much time on emails. That's why we didn't have any more time for anything else. And we like to keep the show generally on an hour, hour and a half. So, and Nick wasn't here, so we blame it on Nick. So,
yeah,
it's all Nick's fault.
Yeah, I agree. Nick's fault. Anyway, join us next week, and we'll be back with another new show. Will, you going to be at a convention next week or no?
Oh, no, no, no. Next week, I am here.
Okay, good.
With you all. My next convention ain't until July, July 4th weekend. I want to say the 7th, 8th, 9th, 8th, 9th, 10th, wherever that weekend is right there. That's PaizoCon.
Ooh.
I'm going to be in North Texas RPG Con next week, but Sunday it usually be really slow, so I'll probably come home. Like, Matt, you skipped the last day of Origins today, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I was able to make connections and get all my interviews done, and I pretty much spent my Origins budget Saturday, so I'm like, I'm not driving 90 minutes back to Columbus just to mill about the exhibit hall, since I'll be also going to Gen Con, because anything I spend at this point comes out of the Gen Con budget.
Did you do any game in there?
I played some HeroClix. I demoed a couple games. I demoed Mage Wars. It's a game that's not released out. They had some late prototypes. It's a living card game that's with some tactics involved. You're basically a wizard, and you have your spell book of spells, but instead of it being a deck, you actually have all your spells available at the start of the game, and you assemble your deck based on like a point total. So we want to play with like 100 points of spells or 200 points or whatever. So you construct it that way, and then you're bringing in creatures, moving them on the board, and that sort of thing. It was interesting. And then I also played, see the Summoner Wars, which is another living card game with actually similar mechanics to Mage Wars, the iOS game, that'll be released in, I think, like mid-July. And it's similar to Mage Wars, except that's more of the, you build your deck and you're drawing cards, and then you have to cast your spells out of the cards you draw. The iOS app seemed to do a decent job of actually recreating the game. They were still working on some UI issues with that. That and plus, I don't actually have an iPad. I have an Android tablet. Thank you very much. I have an Asus Transformer that I absolutely love. But
I have a Thrive.
Nice. But
Toshiba Thrive. I don't know if it's nice or not.
But still, you have a tablet. Vince, you have an iPad?
I have an iPad and I have a Galaxy Samsung pad.
Okay. Does the iPad involve a lot of double tapping to do anything?
No, not at all.
Okay, that was just their choice of game design. There was a lot of things you had to double tap where I wanted to single tap. When I played their game, I was trying to do just what my instincts were. Weren't quite always how they worked. So, but that's still some stuff they're hammering out, so maybe we'll see a change in that. Because the game itself was fine, they're actually going to have online play for Summoner Wars, too, so... And it'll be a free-to-play that you can just buy expansions for. But, yeah, so that was fun. And then I played a card game, Carnival. It was a dice-rolling game where you're trying to assemble carnival rides. It was okay. It was just kind of random because it's just dice-rolling, and the dice tell you what you can do. Like, you roll three dice. Each, whatever number you roll, tells you what you can do with the dice. Either draw, discard, steal a card from another... And you get to pick two of what you rolled. And I think that's really all the gaming I got done. It was mostly just running around interviewing game companies. I got to do a Q&A with Felicia Day with like 14 other people in the room. I actually got a recording of that that I'm going to transcribe for a diehard game fan. I may see about releasing it in audio form if the audio's up to snuff. But so we'll have to see how the sound in the room was, because I was like halfway across the room from her. So it may not be the most pleasant listening experience. And then I did meet Will Wheaton and Felicia Day and had them sign a shake weight.
Will Wheaton.
Okay. Wheaton!
Yes, I was supposed to have a Q&A with him. There was supposed to be a media Q&A with him as well, but that ended up being canceled. Apparently he had to nap.
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah. It's tiring being at gaming conventions, and he, as he even said in that Twitter post, he's old.
Exhausting. Will Wheaton. What a loser.
Yeah. And then, but yeah, it was, and yeah, really, that's all the gaming I did there, though. So, and I played quite a bit of HeroClix too, and won the two convention figures, the Apocalypse and Dr. Fate.
Mm.
So, yeah. So that, yeah, that was pretty much my origins.
Was that fun?
Yep.
All right. Well, for tonight, so we're gonna say keep it original, keep it old school, and good night, everybody.
Good night.
All right. Take care.
Roll for initiative.